You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, the WPR News Department is launching a year-long series called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. We'll hear the first installment and get an overview of the project. First, prison reform is a big issue in the United States on the local and national level. From the FBI investigation into Wisconsin's troubled youth prisons to President Donald Trump's declaration during his campaign that he was the law and order candidate, questions surrounding the effectiveness of prison as it stands today remain on the table. That's probably because the U.S. has 5% of the world's population, but 25% of its prisoners. America has more prisoners than any other nation and the highest incarceration rate in the world. John Pfaff joins us now to talk about the causes behind mass incarceration. He's a professor of law at Fordham Law School and the author of the book Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
How does the United States look against its fellow liberal democracies like England and Germany when it comes to our rates of mass incarceration?
We are staggeringly higher than where they are. So our total incarceration rate is on the order of about something around 650 to 700 people per 100,000. England, which has the highest rate in Western Europe, is around 200. Places like France and Germany are around 95 or 100 per 100,000. So we're about 6 to 7 times higher than many European countries.
But it wasn't always like that, right? There was a time when the United States was on par with countries like that, and then suddenly this divide emerged. What happened?
So yeah, you're right, that between the 1920s to the mid-1970s, the United States maybe was slightly more punitive than Europe, but not by much. And our rate was fairly stable at around 100, 120 per 100,000 people. And then in the mid-1970s, it started to grow. And it didn't really explode. We talk about sort of this explosion in incarceration. I don't think that's right. It just grew at this steady, unrelenting pace for basically 40 years until 2010, when it finally leveled off and started sort of a slow, very gradual decline that continues to today. And we don't really have a great understanding of exactly what drove it. Some of it was rising crime. Crime was going up during the 60s and 70s, and some of that rise in incarceration was a reaction against that. But the fact is that as crime fell starting in the 1990s, prison populations kept rising and rising as well. And so what I've spent the past sort of 10 years of my life doing is trying to figure out really what's been behind it.
And it has it hasn't reversed hugely, but it sounds as though there has been a little bit of contraction in the last several years, right?
There has, although it's important to realize that over half of the decline has taken place just in the state of California, and half the states in the country have seen their prison populations rise during that time, and half have seen them fall. So we're still not in some sort of broad national decline. When prison populations rose, all 50 states saw their populations rise. As they decline, it's only half the states, and most of that is just one state. So it's still a very, very tentative and slow-going process right now.
Now, in your book, you challenge what you call the standard story about why rates are going up, and these include three things, three tenets of the standard story, that the war on drugs, draconian sentencing laws, and the private prison complex. You take those on. What do you think is wrong with the standard story?
The problem with the standard story isn't that what it points to are irrelevant. The war on drugs, longer sentences, private prisons, those have mattered. But they're always secondary to something else that's more important, and that more important thing gets lost in the debate. So we talk about the war on drugs. But the fact is, in the state prison system that holds almost all the prisoners nationwide, only 16% are in prison for drugs. And over half of all people in prison are there for a violent crime. So if you really want to cut back on prison populations, at some point we'll start to have to ask really difficult questions about how do we punish people who have been convicted of violence. And when we talk about longer sentences, most people spend, I think, less time in prison than the average person thinks. That the median time in prison someone convicted of violence spends is about 4 years. For a drug or a property crime is barely a year. And what's really driven prison growth isn't people getting locked up and spending really long periods of time there. It's fact we've just been admitting more and more and more people. And that points not to these legislative sentences, but the prosecutor, these county prosecutors become more aggressive. And when we talk about private prisons, only about 8% of all prisoners are held in private prisons. Almost everyone is held in the state prison. And people refer to private prisons as these great profiteers of incarceration, and it's true they make a profit. But the two biggest firms made about $400 million combined on prisons last year. Wages alone for the public prisons came to $25 billion versus $400 million, right? So guard unions have a much bigger role in driving this than the private prisons do.
I want to zero in on the first point there, because that has been a major focal point of prison reform efforts so far, that if we decriminalize nonviolent offenses, property crimes, that we can go a long way toward turning a ship around on mass incarceration. If you're saying it's so ineffective, why has that been a focus?
So as a political reality, that's where it had to start. You've had 40 years of unrelenting prison growth. And when reformers started to really push back hard against that, and it started in 2000 a little bit, but it really picked up steam in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, you're not going to start by targeting serious violent offenses, right? Drugs was the most logical and the most reasonable point to begin a reform effort. So that's where they started. The problem is it's not where we can end. And we have, I think, convinced Americans that we can get most of the way where we want to go just by focusing on drugs. And that's simply not true, even if it was where the process had to start.
Right now, we are talking with John Pfaff, professor of law at Fordham Law School, and the author of the book Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. And lastly, you were zeroing in on the prison, private prisons, and the role they may play there. They may have, among some circles, among critics, a reputation as being, as you said, profiteers. You're saying we need to look instead to politicians and public unions for one aspect, and those employed there. And that represents a turnaround, doesn't it? What is happening there when we look at the real beneficiaries?
I think the problem is that the idea of sort of profiting off prison in an explicit way, the way the private prison firms do, horrifies people at a very sort of fundamental level. And I think it's harder to realize that guard unions and the like are basically doing the same thing, right? That they are going to protect their wages just the same way that private prisons are going to try to protect their profits, and they're going to lobby for tougher laws and lobby against prison closures in just the same way. And I think a good example of this comes from my own state of New York. New York has one of the longest declines in prison population nationwide. We've been shrinking since 1999. We've dropped about 25,000 prisoners from 80,000 to around 55,000. Yet spending on prisons hasn't gone down at all. We spend just as much today, if not more, than we did 10 years ago. And that's because the guard unions have been very effective at making sure we don't close prisons, that we lay off guards at a slower rate, and they fought very hard to preserve the money that was flowing to them. And the politicians who have prisons fight for that as well. And so I think the same underlying pathologies exist, but it's not quite so transparent, and so it's managed to sort of sneak under the reformist radar.
What about answering kind of big picture questions like, do prisons work, and what makes for an effective prison, both for society and for the person who ends up incarcerated?
I think that's a great point, and one that's generally underappreciated, which is that the evidence suggests that as a form of crime control, prison is actually a very ineffective approach. It did help staunch the rising crime during the 80s and help bring it down in the 90s, but we could have accomplished the same crime drop in a much more efficient, much less costly kind of way, had relied much more on better policing and less on prisons. There's no evidence that prison deters, that the threat of some long sentence being imposed at some point down the line doesn't affect behavior of those who are committing crimes today. If nothing else, people who commit violent crimes tend to be younger people, and younger people tend to live much more in the moment. They're less forward-thinking. There's also little evidence that we incapacitate effectively. We tend to think that we'll just lock this person up because they pose a threat to society. But the fact is most people, not only do they age into criminal behavior, that, you know, an 18-year-old is much more likely to engage in violence than a 10-year-old, but they also age out of crime. That when you start entering your late 20s, early 30s, you're less likely to engage in criminal behavior. There are hormonal shifts, there are attitudinal shifts, you're just physically weaker. You get married, you have a job, and these are all pathways out of engaging in criminal conduct. And so we tend to sort of throw the book at people just as they're about to start aging out of crime. So it doesn't deter, and it doesn't tend to incapacitate very well. And there, especially in times like this, where crime is low but prison populations are incredibly high, it's almost impossible to justify our current incarceration rate from a public safety perspective.
Is it really that simple that people age out of crime? Aren't some people maybe lifelong offenders?
They are. There's a small subset that tend to persist for long periods of time. But the challenge we face is that we can't identify who they are when they're younger. There's not many of them, and if we try to lock someone when they're 20 on the risk that they might be offending when they're 40, we're going to lock up many, many people, young people, who aren't going to pose that kind of risk. The other challenge we face is that some of the biggest pathways out of crime are things like marriage and employment. And when you send someone who's young to prison, you make it harder for them to get married or get employed when they come out, so it actually undermines future pathways out of crime if we lock too many people up when they're younger.
We're talking with John Pfaff right now. He's the author of Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think is behind mass incarceration in the United States? How do you think policymakers can solve the problem? Have you ever been part of the prison population in this country? What was it like? What was your experience? You can call us now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page, and we'll pick up that conversation and get to your calls in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now with John Pfaff, the author of Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How would you like to see the prison system change in the United States? What do you think is behind the growing number of people in prison? If you or someone close to you has ever been in prison before, you can call and share your experience at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Matthew joining us in Baraboo. Matthew, hi.
Yeah, hi. I had a question. I was wondering if the whole plea bargain system has caused some of the mass incarceration, the push to make people plead guilty just to get them through the system faster, has affected that at all.
Matthew, thanks for that. And John, what do you say to that and the role of prosecutors?
I think that's a huge part of it, that prosecutors have played a major role driving prison populations up, and I think plea bargaining plays a big role in that. And I think what really plays a huge part in the plea bargaining process is that the person on the other side of the table from the prosecutor, the public defender, is woefully underfunded. Every defendant in the United States is entitled to a lawyer, and as every Law and Order episode says, you know, if you can't afford one, the state has to give you one. And about 80% of all people facing prison qualify for a public defender. Yet we systematically underfund public defenders just in general, and especially compared to prosecutors. And so prosecutors have a tremendous discretion and tremendous budgetary power, and they're facing against public defenders who are overwhelmed with caseloads they can't manage, and they can't afford to hire investigators, while at the same time the prosecutors simply can use the police to investigate for them for free. Public defenders have to hire lab services. Prosecutors can use the state DNA lab for free. And it's such an asymmetric situation that public defenders lack the ability to really, as dedicated as they are, to really push back against this prosecutorial power. And that makes the plea bargaining process grind on even more powerfully than it has in the past.
And John, you actually suggest having sentencing guidelines for prosecutors.
Exactly. I think that instead of trusting prosecutors to use their discretion, we should impose guidelines on them about what cases they're allowed to file charges against, what cases they're allowed to file misdemeanors versus felonies when they have to divert to a drug court. All these things are completely within their discretion. No court can review them. They get to choose who to charge, what to charge them with. And that's an incredible grant of power that no one else in a criminal justice system has. And no one who has that kind of power, like judges, have it with no restrictions or guidelines whatsoever.
Well, thank you for that call, and we're going to go next to Kyle in Dubuque, Iowa. Kyle, hi.
Hello. I had a question for your guest, though. I was wondering, I've been thinking about this for a while. With the welfare system, I think it pays quite a bit and enough that people will not accept jobs because of, if I accept the job, you know, I lose my benefits. And I think when they do that, they have all this free time on their hand, and kind of like the idols. idle time is the devil's playground. And I think it also discourages marriage because, if I get married, I'll lose my benefits. And I'm wondering what role welfare plays in it. I know there's a need for welfare, but I think being abused so bad, I think it's hurting people and putting them in the criminal justice system more than helping people.
Kyle, thanks for that. And John, is there anything to that? Is there a link between public aid recipients and winding up in prison?
Certainly not that kind of causal connection, that being on welfare pushes you into committing crime because you don't want a job or and you're idle. The people who receive benefits, they would much rather be working. And the fact they're on benefits is more reflects sort of the structural barriers they face to employment. That one thing that defines a lot of, especially minority high crime neighborhoods, is a general systematic exclusion from good work. Right? Those jobs just aren't in poor minority urban neighborhoods, and they lack the social connections to get them. They lack their underfunded schools don't prepare them for that. And so to say that the benefits are what lead them to crime, I think, grossly understates the kind of pressures that those people face and sort of the general sort of exclusion from gainful employment that causes them to turn to benefits, not that drives them to crime. And the marriage point, I think, actually is a good segue to show just how much our level of incarceration can throw off, not that incarceration, not welfare, throws off social systems. Marriage and dating functions best in a neighborhood when there's about one man for every woman. You need about a 50-50 ratio. In some heavily policed neighborhoods, we've arrested so many young men that it actually throws off that ratio from 50-50 to, in some cases, it can be as off as 60-40, which does undermine marriage. But it undermines marriage because it's removed so many young men from the neighborhood that it actually makes it harder for women to find partners. And those men who return from prison in these heavily policed neighborhoods, they're even more systematically denied access to jobs. Parts of their parole often denies them access to jobs. It says they can't have contracts, they can't drive cars. And one of the more crazy examples, New York State fixes, other states have not. One of the biggest training programs in prison is barber school. Yet in states across the country, people with felony records are denied barber's license. We train them to be barbers and then deny them access to actually the barbering industry when they leave. And then when they ultimately recidivate because they can't get a successful job, we blame them, not the barriers we placed in front of them to make an already difficult transition all the harder.
Well, thanks a lot for that question. As we talk with John Pfaff, professor of law at Fordham Law School, I should say, and the author of Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about these ideas, treating people who commit violent crimes differently, changing the sentencing there, changing the way prosecutors approach what they're looking for when they try a case? What do you think of that at 800-642-1234? And we go next to Laura in Burlington. Laura, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. From what I understand and what I've read, approximately 25% of people that are incarcerated are mentally ill. And the guest had indicated that there had been an increase in the 70s. And I'm wondering if that didn't correspond with the fact that we were closing the institutions where a lot of these folks that were seriously ill with mental illness were living. And then the other thought that I had on that is, was that something that he addressed in his book, or I guess just what his thoughts are on it, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Lauren, thanks for that. And John, what about mental illness as a correlation?
I think the deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill that took place over the course that started actually in the 60s on to the 80s is one of the things that is a very plausible story, but the actual effect is less than people expect it to be. So the best study I've seen on this suggests that about 10% of people in prison would not be there if we had more hospital beds available to them. And again, that's 10% of a 1.5 million person prison system, right? So that's not a trivial number of people. That's hundreds, like almost 200,000 people that get implicated in this. but it's not a primary driver. The story might be different for jails. The difference between prisons and jails is prison is where we send people who have been convicted of a serious crime, a felony, something that requires at least a year in lockup. Jail is for people being held before trial who can't make bail, or people convicted of misdemeanors. And it's quite possible that jails have a much different experience with mental health, because they have in some ways become sort of the frontline intake for mental health issues. In fact, the biggest mental health hospital in the country right now is Cook County Jail in Chicago. Right. So I think that is a serious issue, that we'd be much better served trying to treat the mental illness outside of prison. But I'd also emphasize that the one risk of this, of sort of focusing on sort of mentally ill people in prison, is that it's important to remember that mentally ill people are much more likely to be the victims of crime than the perpetrators. That we sort of view that those who commit crimes tend to be the mentally ill, and we need to focus on helping those who are mentally ill not engage in violent and other kinds of antisocial behavior. But we don't want to lose sight of the fact that the bigger risk untreated mental illnesses is for being victimized, not for being the victimizer.
And John, as we wrap up, in the beginning of your book, you talk about how Hillary Clinton seemed to be the candidate who would be more sympathetic to calls for prison reform. Donald Trump billed himself as a law and order candidate. So given that Donald Trump is now the president of the United States, where does that leave prison reform efforts?
I think for prison reform, who's in D.C. doesn't really matter all that much. That who really matters at the end of the day is the county elected prosecutor, who answers to almost no one. And there's lots of evidence around the country of prosecutors who even ignore what the governors want them to do. And so I think they'll definitely, if they don't want to follow what the president does, they won't. Now, the president might give them some sort of political cover to be tougher if they want to be tougher on crime, but those reformers who want to be, those DAs who want to be reformers, I think will have the room to do that. And I think one interesting aspect of the 2016 campaign was that while millions of people voted for Donald Trump and his very tough on crime rhetoric, about 20 reform-minded prosecutors won elections against tough on crime incumbents. And that's an unusually high number of defeats for incumbents. And those campaigns were premised on an idea of being smarter.
And we leave it there. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was John Pfaff, professor of law at Fordham Law School and the author of Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. This is Central Time.